Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and I'm sure you'll agree we have something very special in store for you. We have an outstanding guest. He's been a frequent guest on Health Talk, and now he's joining us on the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. He is the originator of the paleo diet. He is the real deal. He's a guy who many years ago formulated the notion that we are poorly adapted as modern humans to the environment we've created, and he has explored our Paleolithic and Stone Age origins to come up with a better approach to health. He is Dr. Loren Cordain, of course, and he's the world's foremost authority on the evolutionary basis of diet and its relationship to disease. He's been all over the place. This paleo concept is exploding. He's been on Dateline NBC. He's made the front page of Wall Street Journal and the New York Times. And we're very proud to say that we knew him when, as he was beginning to publicize his research. He is a rigorous scientist. He is the recipient of a Scholarly Excellence Award at Colorado State University. He is a biologist anthropologist who has studied human origins and has attempted to match the facts about our human anatomy and physiology with the answer to the conundrum: what should we be eating? How should we live? Without further ado, welcome, Dr. Cordain. It's nice having you once again to talk to.
Oh, thank you, Ron. I really appreciate it, and that was a very kind introduction. And it's always good to kind of get back to the roots and the people that recognize this early on. And it's just a pleasure to be on your show and talk with you. You're one of my favorite people in this community.
Well, that's very kind. Thank you. We're a mutual admiration society for sure. So tell us a little bit about, once again, you know, how you got involved in this study, because it's become a lifetime research focus for you. When did you get interested in Paleolithic nutrition?
Yeah, Ron, that's actually my passion. That's what I've been doing for the last 20 to 25 years, is studying this. And I originally got involved in 1987, which was exactly 2 years after Boyd Eaton published his famous paper in the New England Journal of Medicine called Paleolithic Nutrition. And I read that paper, and at the time, in 1987, I thought, wow, this was the best idea I've ever heard on what people should be eating. And, of course, I had a background in physiology and health that it made me interested. It's also exercise as well. And so I read virtually every cross-reference to that first paper. And, of course, you know, as a physician and scientist yourself, is that every scientific paper has additional cross-references. Right. And so I got those papers, and I got those cross-references from the original Eaton article, and I started reading the cross-references. And I started accumulating this, you know, hundreds and then thousands of scientific papers. And this was the day and age before the internet and before all electronics and PDF files and everything.
So you literally had to go into the stacks, the lonely stacks of the library, and you know, pull out these dusty old manuscripts and tomes and not see the light of day for many days at a time, probably.
That's right. You know, so what a researcher can do on a computer at home in this day and age, it took me months and even years to do. I accumulated all these papers, and I started to see patterns. It's kind of like putting together a jigsaw puzzle. Stone Age people didn't drink milk. They didn't eat dairy products. They had a low-salt diet. They didn't eat refined sugars. They didn't eat grains. They didn't eat legumes. They didn't do this. They didn't do that. And so each one of those articles that started off as one or two articles became a file folder, which was filled with other articles, which was then filled with more and more file folders. And before I knew it, I had 20,000 papers all organized into, you know, the, kind of the outlines of a jigsaw puzzle. And so I started to get insight into this stuff. And when I did, back in the early 90s, I got up enough courage to make a telephone call to Boyd Eaton, who is a physician. He's a a working radiologist in Atlanta, Georgia. He's also an adjunct faculty at Emory University. And we spoke for almost an hour. And at the end of that conversation, he said, "Wow, it sounds to me like you know more about this than I do," which was it was the greatest, you know, flattering comment I'd ever heard in my life. And
of course, he was the author of the landmark article or book, Stone Agers in the Fast Lane.
That's right. And so Boyd really is the godfather. I mean, I don't, even though I was kind of at ground zero on this whole movement, I certainly don't take sole credit by any means for it. And Boyd is the godfather of the movement. And so anyway, he came up to CSU, Colorado State University. I invited him up. He gave a talk. I got acquainted. We started writing papers together, and I guess the rest is history.
Right. And so now, you know, the paleo movement, I mean, really, it's become a movement. You know, here in New York, we have, you know, paleo runners groups. We have paleo dieters support groups. It's all the rage. And, you know, people are blogging and people are writing. And, in looking at all this, do you look at this with excitement and pride, or do you sometimes kind of shake your head and say, I don't know, maybe people are bastardizing this paleo concept, co-opting it, and, you know, they're making paleo bars, you know, that are, you know, supposedly using ingredients that might be Stone Age compatible, but probably are pretty much industrialized and refined. Does that bother you?
Well, you know, you asked me two questions, and so let me answer the first, and then I'll answer the second
one.
Yeah, I am extremely, gratified, happy, you know, any of those terms about, wow, this thing has really come full circle. It's to the point now where when you and I were first involved way back in the day when we went to some of those early conferences, it was kind of a novelty that, oh, yeah, this is a great idea. And people like yourself and others, Robert Crayon included, picked up on it and thought that this was really kind of the wave of the future. But that way back then, as you well recognize, is that we really didn't have that much of a following, and it was kind of a closet concept that you know, people that were involved in nutrition and health and diet knew about. But most people didn't, and now there's few people that haven't heard about this, and so it's very, very gratifying to see an idea that you and I embraced, you know, many, many years ago, now become bigger than gluten-free, bigger than vegetarian, if you do those kind of Google searches. So it's an enormous concept. There are hundreds of books out there, and thousands or tens of thousands of websites and blogs, and people are talking about this all over the world. But I think you're right, is that anytime a concept like this becomes that big, it becomes fragmented with many versions of what is and is not paleo. And so that's a little bit troublesome for me, but you know, you have to expect that as ideas grow and blossom, is that there's going to be different takes on it. But
yeah, imitation is the greatest form of flattery. I guess you can console yourself with that.
You're absolutely right. So yeah, I have problems with some of the stuff that is out there on in people's popular books, and even books probably they're doing quite well. They advocate the use of sea salt. Well, sea salt is basically the same as regular salt. I mean, there's a few subtle differences in terms of the, you know, trace minerals and what have you, but for all intents and purposes, physiologically, it affects you just the same. So using sea salt in paleo recipes really doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And there are some versions of paleo in which they suggest that dairy products are, you know, a good thing to do. Mm-hmm. So milk, cheese, yogurt, and so forth are part of it. Yet clearly our Stone Age ancestors couldn't consume or eat dairy products because you can't milk a wild animal. You can't even mm-hmm. walk next to it.
Well, that's actually, you know, a good example, because, you know, if we're supposed to emulate Stone Age principles or Stone Age biology, how do we fix a moment in time when humans evolved to the point where they are environmentally ready for modern life? In other words, do we go back 5 or 8 million years when our ancestors are just beginning to descend from trees, and they had primarily a vegetarian diet. I think that's what some vegetarian apologists say, is let's look at the, you know, very, very ancient diet of primates, monkeys, because they mostly subsisted on plant foods. Should we fast forward to 10 or 12,000 years ago, when people began to domesticate animals? They milked animals. They found pottery shards now in Sumeria, where people stored milk and fermented it into cheese, which overcame lactose intolerance, suggesting that we may have adapted to some of these modern foods, modern conditions, maybe greater salt content in recent millennia. I mean, it sort of begs the question, when did evolution stop?
Well, I think that begs really a couple of key questions and key issues in this whole business. Is, first off, neither myself or Boyd Eaton or any of the other scientists, academicians that have been involved with, never did we once say there was a single quote-unquote paleo diet. There was, it's kind of like a bell-shaped curve. There was a variety of diets that differed by geography, by season, by location, and as you pointed out, more importantly, by time. So where do we start and stop this notion of a paleo diet, and what comprises, you know, a diet that emulates what our Stone Age ancestors ate? So, an excellent point. And it's kind of looking at shades of white and black and gray, is that things changed over time. And you're absolutely right, is that the further back in time we get to the point where we have the last common ancestor between chimps and humans, we're looking at almost entirely or primarily a vegetarian, fruitarian type diet. And as we fast forward, so that split in time happened about 5 to 7 million years ago, when apes and hominids, bipedal apes, split.
We began to stand upright instead of swinging from trees and walking on our knuckles.
That's absolutely right. And so the very first bipedal apes were probably eating a diet that was essentially plant-based. But we do know that the evidence suggests that they were omnivorous as well. So if we go back and look at those earliest fossils, that we can, they're what are called stable isotopes, and we can go back as far as we can collect delta 13 carbon, and all the data points towards the notion that we were always omnivores. Chimpanzees are omnivores; they're not herbivores. So once we became upright, started walking, then we and then. At one point in time, we started making tools, and once we started making stone tools, the evidence suggests that we were eating more and more and more animal food. And as we fast forward, then that point was about 3.5 to 2.5 million years ago, and the isotopic signature, the delta 13 carbon, also shows that we were probably eating more and more animal food. So we can triangulate it, and literally eating animal food is what made us human. And we've published a couple of papers showing how increasing animal food caused a process called encephalization, in which our brain size increased. So it's not a static process. There's not one uniform diet. But one of the things that, if you want to kind of focus in on, is we are a member of the genus Homo. We are Homo sapiens. And the genus Homo arose about 200,000 years ago in Africa. So most scientists who are involved in this paleo diet concept would indicate that if we take that point forward and build that bell-shaped curve of what the dietary characteristics are, that's probably what shaped our current genome, who and what we are now, and that the characteristics of the diet of species of Homo, and you're absolutely right, Homo moved all over the planet. Homo could be
A very adaptable species. I mean, that's like one
very,
of the
very adaptable. We can live in the far north, the Inuit. We can live in the Kalahari Desert. And so, there was a wide variety of diets that were consumed. But regardless of that, once we became Homo, there are a number of characteristics that appear, and in the archaeologic as well as isotopic record that show that all species of Homo, if and when they could, would eat a animal-based diet if it was possible. Now, there are some situations in which in the environmental conditions it wasn't, but under those conditions, they would prefer animal food. And the best available evidence suggests that they ate about a little over half as animal food and the balance as plant foods. And the huge issue here is that they ate all wild food, all wild plants, and all wild animals. And so what our research group has done is we've looked at the nutritional characteristics of wild plant and animal foods, and we've contrasted those to modern foods. 70% of the calories in the typical Western diet come from four foods. They come from cereal grains, refined sugars, refined vegetable oils, and dairy products. Mm-hmm. Those four foods, you can call it a Twinkie, a donut, a pizza, mm-hmm. You know, a slice of bread, cereal, you can call it whatever you want. But those four food components, refined sugars, grains, vegetable oils, and dairy, make up 70% of the calories in the typical Western diet. And that's really the problem. In Stone Age diets, no matter where you go back in time, forward in time, before Homo, after Homo, nobody, no hominid ever ate 70% of their calories from those four food groups. As a matter of fact, they rarely or never consume those four food groups, and that's really the problem. So when we define what a paleo diet is, we need to look at a bell-shaped curve. And the modern diet is not one or two standard deviations above or below what we consumed. There's seven or eight standard deviations.
It's a total disconnect from the
prior diet. It's a disconnect. Yeah, so biologically, we're doing something that our system has never, ever encountered.
Now, to be the devil's advocate, there are people who are proponents of a more vegetarian style of eating who cite evidence suggesting that it was only when we began to cultivate grains and store them and in the ancient empires of Babylonia and Egypt, that civilization got its real start. So from the standpoint of these proponents of a starch-based diet, there's actually a book called The Starch Solution, I think. It's gone so far as to suggest that we should eschew animal fat and eat starchy vegetables and fruits as our main sources of food. They're saying that this is what makes us human, is that we, you know, we eat, we cultivate grains, and we've developed cultivars, agricultural products that sustain us. What's your rebuttal to that?
Well, it has to do with population dynamics, is that if you're a farmer, you can feed two or three or five or six people. And you may not have as long of a lifespan, but you can make more people. And that's exactly what the agricultural revolution allowed us to do, is that once we sowed the seeds of grains, one guy could feed five guys or 10 guys or 20 guys or even now in the modern day, 20,000 people.
So what you're saying is it didn't make us healthier, but it did manage to create population centers and population explosion.
Exactly. And that's the point, is that if you look at it from that perspective, from population density, well, then suddenly we can have specialists. Everybody doesn't have to do everything. And that's in hunter-gatherer societies, everybody does everything. Once you create stratification within society via agriculture, you can have a ruling class. You can have guys that can be soldiers, that can create war. You can have people that can study the cosmos and look up into the stars and
then perform a human sacrifice according to the signs of the zodiac.
You can become a metallurgist, right, and you can make metal. And so that becomes your specialty. And once society stratifies and we have specialties, then we can move forward because we don't all have to do everything.
And that would seem outwardly like a sign of progress, but compare the health of, you know, in terms of the anthropological evidence, the health of the average hunter-gatherer, say, 20,000 years ago, to a farmer in ancient Babylonia or ancient Egypt, which were healthier, which have better bone structure, better teeth, less evidence of epidemic disease?
Well, you know, I mean, that goes without saying is that the archaeologic studies, because clearly we can't go in and examine somebody that lived 20,000 years ago because they're not alive, and we can do all kinds of cool things in this day and age, including epidemiologic studies, tissue studies, and so forth. So what we have to rely on is the archaeologic evidence, and as you pointed out, when people first developed agriculture, what we have is the fossil record primarily, and the fossil record tells us that they became shorter, they started to develop dental caries, they started to develop osteoporosis. There's another disease called parotic osteoporosis where there's demineralization around the bone and the cribra orbitalia, the area surrounding the eye socket. So the archaeologic evidence supports the notion that people actually got less healthier, they didn't live as long, more problems during childbirth, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
More epidemic disease, perhaps?
More epidemic disease. That also, there are signs in the skeletal system that suggest that as well. So these people were living together in communities, and when you do that, then there's more chance of infectious disease to come about, and many of the infectious diseases are thought to have originated in the animals that we had domesticated and we were living basically. I mean, right now you put cows in a barn or a corral away from your home, but then those animals were living basically with the people. And so the diseases were communicable and they were transferred. And so there's a huge body of literature showing that most of these communicable diseases that are impacting us came from these animals that we were living with.
So let's focus in on, you know, what are the particulars of the paleo diet, because some people are really up on this and other people are just being introduced to the concept. What foods are paleo and what foods are considered non-paleo?
Well, you know, I think that you asked me if I had any reclamations or doubts about this whole thing, and I think maybe that the whole notion of paleo, that might not have been a very good word, but mm-hmm. You know, like it or not, that's what it has become to categorize this way of eating in the contemporary world. And you know, when the concept is criticized by some scientists or whatever, it's because they're really unaware of what it is we're trying to do. We're not trying to eat precisely in the manner that hunter-gatherers ate it.
Otherwise, we'd be eating insects, termites. We'd be digging for tubers in the soil. You know, eating bitter weeds and tart little berries that were the original food of humans.
That's right. Exactly. It's impossible for us to, in the 21st century, to eat like a hunter-gatherer. First, none of us have access to wild animal meat, or very few of us unless you're a hunter. Secondly, none of us have time to go out and gather wild plant foods, and as you mentioned, even if we do, they don't taste very good. Our cultural taste for animal foods runs primarily with the muscle meat. We don't like to eat organ meats. We don't mm-hmm. like liver or kidney or
and that's
marrow.
Actually very paleo because, the cliche in the Indian movies about Indians is when they kill the buffalo, they use the whole buffalo. They use it all.
Well, that's not the cliche. That's actually the science.
Is yes.
That hunter-gatherers
yes.
ate everything. And so what is it we're trying to do with this modern-day quote-unquote paleo that is now, that word has become associated with this way of eating? We're trying to emulate, and I've pointed this out for over a decade, we're trying to emulate the food groups that they ate. Not necessarily the precise foods, but the food groups. And the food groups that our ancestors ate were wild plant and animal foods. And they are primarily wild fruits, wild vegetables, wild tubers, and wild animals. So what we can do is we can eat foods from the supermarket, cultivated vegetables, cultivated fruits, and if you can afford it, you can get grass-produced animal products. And then eschew the processed foods, the grains, the dairy products, and the refined sugars that comprise 70% of the Western diet. Get those out of your diet. Replace them with foods that mimic the nutrients and food groups that our ancestors ate. And lo and behold, everything starts getting better. So if you're overweight or obese and you decide to get rid of grains and dairy and refined sugars and processed foods and refined vegetable oils, what's left? Real food. And so that's really the idea behind this is, you know, even though it's called paleo, it is paleo only to the degree that it mimics the foods, that the food groups that our ancestors ate. And Ron, you've been preaching this for probably as long as you've been on board in this the health and medical community, is that we shouldn't be eating processed foods. We shouldn't be.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and so it's like this is really a no-brainer in terms of how people should be eating in the 21st century. And I think that part of the problem just has to do with the terminology and how it all got out to be Stone Age and Paleo and this and that, whatever. In a way it is, but in a way it isn't.
Well, there are actually some additional refinements to the paleo diet that you know, can be somewhat controversial, because if you go into a typical health food store or a health restaurant, you know, you'll be offered delicacies like hummus or lentil soup, fresh garden potatoes, heirloom tomatoes, chili peppers, eggplants. And these are some of the things that you point out may actually not be naturals for humans. How is it that could be the case?
Well, you know, I mean, you kind of have an embedded question in there, but you're talking about hummus and other products that are made from legumes. And in the 21st century, we have the option of eating basically anything we want. And so the notion that legumes or products made from legumes, like hummus and what have you, I've never suggested that we should be eating legumes on a regular basis. You know, if you do it occasionally, it's probably not going to be a problem. But if you do it regularly and they become part of your regular diet, there's multiple health problems associated with chronic legume consumption that we're just starting to find out. The other issue is nightshades. And
Let's focus on that for a moment, because, you know, some people will think, you know, how's that possible? Legumes are full of fiber. They're relatively low fat. They contain lots of vitamins and minerals, and we're taught that they're extremely beneficial. So what could be the downside to eating legumes? By the way, peanuts included, right? Peanuts being a ground legume.
Well, I guess from a, you know, and this may be news to some of your listeners, but the major problem with legumes is that they are concentrated sources of anti-nutrients. And all plant foods tend to have anti-nutrients, but legumes have this cocktail of anti-nutrients that adversely influences gut physiology. And the best work on legumes and anti-nutrients was going on at the Rowett Institute in Scotland, and it had been going on for almost 20 years. It was led by a fellow by the name of Arpad Pustai, PhD from Pakistan. And they were looking at genetically modified foods. And what they had discovered is that if you take a certain component from wheat called wheat germ agglutinin, which is a lectin, and you genetically introduce it into a cantaloupe, well, it increases the harvest because, or cucumbers or what have you, it increases the harvest because there's less insect predation, less fungus, less loss of food. But on the other hand,
it's almost as if they have their own natural pesticides within them.
Right. And so what Pustai and his research group was saying is that foods genetically modified with the genes of another food to protect them from predation is not a good idea. Well, he lost his job over that, and when that happened, all the funding on lectins and anti-nutrients in the world effectively stopped. And so they were some of the best research in the world was coming out of that lab. And at the time, in the late 80s, we were starting to get a real good handle. Hey, eating legumes and beans is not a good idea. Unfortunately, very few human studies have been done, but there's been a ton of animal studies done, and there's been a ton of tissue studies. So there's, as I mentioned, there's a cocktail of anti-nutrients in legumes that we should not view them as healthy foods, but as potentially unhealthful foods. And I don't know how far you want to go down this road, but we can go as long as you want, and I can tell you what they are and what they do. But
yeah, well, yeah, I think that gets a little technical, and it could also be that certain genetic types have a greater susceptibility to these plant lectins, or maybe that, you know, based on your ancestry, your place of origin, that you're more or less accustomed to these, or less, or more resistant, or less susceptible to problems. But I agree, you know, and the point being is that these are domesticated seeds, basically. They're, you know, not things that were that much part of the original human diet. They're the product of hybridization and agriculture. And
well, more importantly, they're the reproductive materials of plants. And if they don't get into the ground, then the plant can't reproduce. If the plant
so they resist digestion.
So what they've done is they've evolved these secondary compounds to prevent predation. And
actually, they transport themselves by being indigestible. So the animal eats them on one side of the mountain and, you know, goes over to the other side of the mountain, poops them out, and the seeds grow.
Well, that's one evolutionary strategy. There's actually three that are involved. And the strategy with legumes is they have three things that they do. They increase intestinal permeability, and then they have another compound that is toxic. If you've got poison and a predator eats it, the first thing you got to do is you got to make sure the poison gets into the animal. It just because it swallows the seed doesn't guarantee that that toxin is going to get into the circulation of the animal. So almost universally, all legumes and whole grains have evolved mechanisms that increase intestinal permeability so that the toxic compound can get past the gut barrier and get into plasma and do its damage.
And then, you know, trace for us in brief the link between altered intestinal permeability, or sometimes as it's referred to, leaky gut, and various types of human diseases. What does leaky gut do to people that's bad?
Well, there's two sides to the coin, is that leaky gut seems to promote allergy and autoimmunity, and with both of those conditions, you have to have inflammation. And so leaky gut seems to be kind of the universal key that we've been searching for in the gut, that we've been searching for what causes chronic low-level inflammation. Ron, as you well know, you can't have heart disease, you can't have cancer, and you can't have autoimmunity without inflammation. Inflammation drives all of those diseases. So the $64,000 question in nutritional science and in you know, immunology, cardiovascular disease, oncology, is what's driving this chronic background low-level inflammation. Well, now we're starting to get a handle that it's coming from the gut. The gut is the largest interface between our internal body and the outside world. And so the notion had always been was that the gut maintained it in its integrity, and we didn't have to worry about it. But now there's this enormous tidal wave of science that has looked at the gut biome and looked at gut permeability, and lo and behold, if we eat a typical Western diet, most of us have a leaky gut. Mm. And almost everybody in the Western world eats cereal grains. Well, cereal grains have multiple elements in it that predispose people to leaky gut. Most of us don't eat a whole lot of legumes, but when we do, it tends to promote a leaky gut. And also nightshades, nightshades.
Yeah, let's focus on those. What, because people hear about the nightshade family. And, you know, it was an old observation by, I think, what's the name of the original doctor who pointed that out? Was it Dr. Kaufman who pointed out the relationship between
nightshades? He wrote a book. He was a plant scientist from the South, I think, Southern California.
It was in the 1950s or 60s, I think.
I was in the 50s or 60s, I think. And he was from, I don't know, South Carolina or someplace. And of course, the best science of the day in the 60s, so this is just absolutely ridiculous, and there's no basis in science to it. Fast forward 40 years, and there's a huge basis in science for showing that alkaloids that are present in nightshades actually are involved in disease processes. And as you mentioned, there's genetic factors that are involved. You know, lots of people don't have any trouble with them at all, yeah. But some people have huge problems with it.
So. I had a tomato with lunch today. I felt a little guilty, looking forward to my interview with you, but I seem to be okay.
Yeah, well, I have tomato as well, and I have no problems. And actually, if you look at the compounds that are problematic in nightshades, it's not one shoe fits all. So, for instance, in a ripe red tomato, the concentration of a compound called alpha-tomatine is negligible. It's very, very small. But if you eat a green tomato or a small yellow cherry tomato, the concentration of alpha-tomatine is an order of magnitude higher.
Right.
And the notion that alpha-tomatine has adverse effects in humans has been clearly demonstrated in animals. And once again, because the Pusztai lab went out of business and because nobody is studying this in, you know, the 21st century, we have to rely upon those early studies. But the immunological community is very much interested in alpha-tomatine because alpha-tomatine is what's called an immunological adjuvant.
Hmm.
Now, what an adjuvant is that everybody that's listening here, I'm sure, had a vaccine when they were a child, and maybe as a young adult, they had vaccines. Most vaccines, and so when we think about vaccines, we inject these weakened viruses or bacteria into our bodies, and then when the real thing comes along, we have an appropriate immune response, and bingo, we don't get the disease. So polio, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, most vaccines don't work. The body simply ignores them. So if you weaken this agent that causes this disease or that agent that causes that disease and you inject it, it doesn't work. So what immunologists have found out is that if they include what's called an adjuvant along with the vaccine, then what it does is it fires up the immune system, and the immune system goes nuts. So once it sees that immunogen, that protein that was part of that bacteria or virus, along with the adjuvant, now it makes it a robust immune response.
Well, which in that case is good.
In that case is good. However, there are foods that contain adjuvants that are more powerful than the adjuvants that immunologists build to make viruses. And one of the most potent adjuvants discovered is alpha-tomatine.
Mm.
So the notion comes up then is, well, listen, we're ingesting alpha-tomatine, and it's got to go through an epithelial cell barrier. And that's different than if you inject it across skin or intramuscularly. So the immune system acts differently if it goes across an epithelial cell barrier versus injecting it. However, the best animal data suggests that if you put alpha-tomatine across, if you inject, put it in a saline solution and put it in the nasal area of a rat, it does the same thing as if you inject it. So for some people, that's why, some people with autoimmune disease, that's why nightshades are very, very problematic, is because, and alpha-tomatine is one example. We haven't even talked about potatoes, so.
Yep, and potatoes being a natural food, maybe for the Incas of the Andes thousands of years ago. That's where they were originally cultivated, but they've been altered and introduced into the diets of people who are very naive to these new foods, and with bad results, possibly.
Well, it's not just for the Inca. It's for any animal, cows and sheep and anything else. Potatoes are lethally toxic and have been for many, many years. And if you look at the medical literature, there's at least, as far as I'm aware, over 200 lethal poisonings from potatoes in humans. And now the USDA's got a good handle on it. They realize that the compounds in potatoes that are lethally toxic, they control for. So they only allow varieties of potato cultivars that have lower concentrations of two glycoalkaloids. And so a potato, once again, is kind of like a legume seed. It's not in the ground to feed other, to reproduce. And it's a tuber in the ground, and it needs to protect itself from pathogens and viruses and even animals that want to come along and gnaw on it if they can dig it up. So there are two toxic glycoalkaloids that are found in potatoes, and they're primarily found in the outer layer in the skin, which is where they encounter their environment. And the two glycoalkaloids are called alpha-solanine and alpha-chaconine. And they're toxic. They're absolutely toxic, and they're toxic in a dose-dependent manner. So that's what is responsible for killing humans. And what they do is they impair nerve transmission. So the first thing that shuts down is the ability to breathe. So if you get these things in high enough concentrations, and the dose that is lethally toxic versus the dose that is marginally toxic is a very, very narrow range. And if you study the literature, that's the concern, is that we need to keep that dose below that very, very incredibly low range. However, you can get concentrations of alpha-tomatine or alpha-chaconine and alpha-solanine above that threshold level by, as I mentioned, the concentrated sources of these glycoalkaloids are in the potato skin. So if you get the potato skin and you fry it up, these things are impervious to heating. You fry them up, you throw the rest of the potato out, and you eat a quarter pound of potato skins, you can get yourself into real trouble, even though the USDA has got cultivars that are trying to keep those values below a given value. The other thing is, Ron, is that when they get in the gut, they also cause, they increase intestinal permeability because glycoalkaloids are technically called saponins, and all saponins bust up the bilipid membrane.
They have a soap-like effect, a detergent-like effect in the intestine, correct?
Right. That's exactly right. So the word saponin derives from the word soap. And what happens is that when you put soap on a bilipid membrane, which is what all the membranes in our mouth and our GI tract and our stomach and our guts are made up of, the saponin, there's a what's called a cholesterol moiety in the membrane. So the membrane is made up of fatty acids and cholesterol. And the saponins selectively bind the cholesterol moiety. And when they do that, they cause, if there's in high enough concentrations, they cause what's called an exvagination of the membrane, and they make the membrane go upwards, and then they come in sideways, and they bind the cholesterol sideways, and they basically cause the membrane to break up, and it punches a pore into the membrane, and that's how potato glycoalkaloids and tomato glycoalkaloids increase intestinal permeability, which once again is associated with chronic low-level inflammation.
Wow, that's not pretty for potato lovers. So you have a new book. It's actually your fifth book, and it's called The Paleo Answer. And you said to me, you know, prior to the broadcast as we were getting ready, that this is a new book that you're particularly proud of. What's in that book for our listeners that they might find interesting?
Well, you know, the paleo movement, as I mentioned, kind of going back to the very beginning of this interview, the paleo movement has become enormous. It's becoming fractionated, and it's got all kinds of versions of what is and is not paleo. So it took me 7 months to write that book. It was published at the end of 2011, December of 2011, January of 2012. So it's only been out for a year or so. And my intent was to take all the knowledge that I had and hadn't delivered and produce the scientific citations showing what really is and is not, quote-unquote, a contemporary paleo diet. So I've got a chapter in there on what's wrong with dairy products. So people that think that, oh, yeah, I'm getting non-pasteurized, organic, non-homogenized.
Right. And that's really part of that schism in the, you know, your natural ally in this movement away from low fat is the Western Price organization, which advocates a diet that is low in grains or no grains. But the big schism here is that they promote dairy. They say, but you've got to have unpasteurized dairy, natural dairy, and that somehow alters the properties of dairy, making it healthier. And you disagree with that fundamentally.
Yeah, that work actually came out of our laboratory, you know. So we were some of the very first people to blow the horn or blow the whistle on the highly insulinemic effect of dairy, be it whole, skim, pasteurized or unpasteurized, is that all dairy has this paradoxical effect. It's got a very low glycemic index, but it has an insulin index that is higher than white bread or cookies. So it's like if you drink milk, it's like eating chocolate chip cookies in terms of your insulin concentrations. You know, and there's multiple problems with dairy. Dairy is not this simple white substance that's good for everybody and is milk or a milk mustache. It contains at least 47 to 50 psycho or physiologically active peptides that influence our physiology. So milk is loaded with hormones. Virtually all the hormones and physiologically active peptides that are found in cow's blood are found in cow's milk. And the notion always has been, well, you know, those are large molecules, peptides and proteins are large molecules, and they can't get past the gut barrier because we don't digest proteins, we digest amino acids. And so the notion has always been is that those large peptides, a peptide is simply a fragment of amino or a sequence of amino acids in intact proteins, they don't get past the gut. Well, now we know they do. And we know they do for a variety of reasons, particularly if you're eating the Western diet. If you eat whole grains and you're drinking milk, it's almost certain that those peptides, those hormones that are found in milk, are going to get into your bloodstream. And we now have isotopic studies because some of the hormones that are found in bovine milk versus human milk have slight differences. For instance, bovine insulin varies from human insulin by one or two amino acid sequences. And we can label these things isotopically, and it turns out that most young children have antibodies to bovine insulin. Well, wait a minute. Hmm. How did they build antibodies to bovine insulin?
That's not natural, yeah.
If insulin is a large molecule, that's why you have to inject it. That's why you can't take insulin pills if you're diabetic, because it can't get past the gut barrier. So how in the world do most children in the Western world, or many children, have antibodies to bovine insulin? It's because they've got a leaky gut, and the insulin gets through, and the beta cells, B cells, build these antibodies to this foreign protein. So, you know, the people that are in paleo that are saying, hey, wait a minute, you know, milk is a good thing. No, it's not. It causes a super high insulin response, which at one time was thought, well, maybe that's a good thing. No, it's a bad thing. It produces insulin resistance, at least in children. There's one.
And it keeps the body fat on for sure.
You know, the hormones, the insulin response, and in epidemiologic studies, there's so many autoimmune diseases. Milk drinking and type 1 diabetes, that goes back 20 years. Mm-hmm. Milk drinking and multiple sclerosis goes back 30 years. Mm-hmm. So it's dumb. And then how about cheeses? I mean, we all love cheeses, you know. Cheese with a glass of wine or whatever however you like to have your cheeses, slice of cheese. Cheese is absolutely incredibly loaded with salt. And we're in the process on our blog, I'm going to publish this in the next week or two, showing the analysis of salt in cheese. So Stone Age people didn't eat salt to the tune of, you know, 6 or 8 grams a day. Well, get yourself 2 or 3 slices of cheese and you're already up to that level. Another thing is how about ghee? We're thinking many people in the paleo community think ghee. You know, clarified butter is also paleo. It's not. Mm-hmm. Absolutely not. And I've already, on our blog, we've already talked about that. And the problem with ghee is that it contains high concentrations of oxidized cholesterol. And
because of the heating process, you actually may damage the cholesterol because of prolonged heating, correct?
That's right. Well, it's not even prolonged heating. If you look at how ghee is made, ghee is... they take cream or butter, and they basically want to boil off all the water, and that leaves the fat, and then the milk solids are also heated, and they're scraped off or filtered off or put through a sieve or whatever. So in theory, all you have is this oil, this butter oil. But the problem is that the oil that's left behind contains saturated fats and cholesterol. Now, there's not a huge amount of cholesterol, but the cholesterol that remains becomes oxidized. And not all of it does, but some of it does. And so that's really the $64,000 question, is how much of the cholesterol that was heated up during that process to produce ghee becomes oxidized. And the very first study suggested that it was 12.3%. This was a study done in Lancet and published in 1987, and they had suggested that immigrants from Pakistan and India.
Right, I mean, this is like a staple of the South Asian diet, and they have a tremendous incidence of cardiovascular disease, even though many of them are on vegetarian diets.
That's right.
With ghee.
That's right, and so that's one of the suggestions is that ghee might be partially responsible. So in the original study, they analyzed the oxidized cholesterol content of ghee. Turned out that about 12% of it became oxidized under the conditions. To produce ghee, the water is boiled off at between 100 and 118 degrees centigrade. And so the thought was is that we're not getting much oxidized cholesterol. So that was challenged in the next 10 to 15 years after the original paper came out. And they did show that actually if it was produced commercially under those conditions between 100 and 118 degrees, that it was only about 1.5% became oxidized. So it was, the original estimate was way, way low, but the way they did the analysis. However, here's the sticker, is that most people from a Pakistani or Indian background is that they use the ghee. They don't just eat it after it's been produced. They use it to fry food.
Yeah.
And so they fry their foods in ghee. Yeah. And then guess what happens? Now it goes right back up to that 8 to 10% level, which in animal models is used to induce atherosclerosis. Uh-huh. Oxidized cholesterol is one of the most potent inducers of atherosclerosis of hardly
in other words, if they want to study heart disease in animals, they basically give them fried butter ghee to rapidly develop the lesions that they need to study.
In our laboratory, we have an experimental model of atherosclerosis in Yucatan miniature swine, and we can, in within 3 to 6 months, we can take a healthy adult with no atherosclerosis, and we can get them to the point where their arteries are 80% occluded, and we do it with oxidized cholesterol.
Yikes.
So anyway, the final point is not only do the Southeast Asian people use it to fry their food in, which increases the oxidized cholesterol, they're also using it in multiple times. So it's kind of like vegetable oil that we use, pour it back into the bottle and use it again and again and again, and that absolutely takes it through the sky. So anybody that says that ghee is paleo is nuts.
Okay. So these are some of the answers that you're going to find in the new book, The Paleo Answer. And I got to give you a lot of credit because in an unrelenting way, you know, you're pursuing the science behind this. The science doesn't stop when we just say, okay, stop eating grains and eat a lot of animal protein. We have to examine all the anthropological evidence and do the science, do the research, look at the results. And that's what our guest today is all about, Dr. Lauren Cardin.
And Ron, you know what? It's like I go back to the last conference I saw you at, and it's like I think back on our mutual friend Robert Crayon, and, you know, many of your viewers may not know who or what he is, but he was a great guy. He's no longer with us.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what Robert said is he said, always let the data speak for itself. And I think that's so important, not just in the paleo movement, but in anything nutritionally, is you shouldn't rely upon charismatic individuals or people that quote-unquote know how to do things. What we need to rely on is the data and let the data speak for itself. And that I think that's I think that's where this paleo movement, why it's so strong and why it won't go away, why it's not the Beverly Hills grapefruit diet or anything else. It was not invented by any single person. It was not promoted by any single person. It was scientists from a variety of disciplines around the world who got it, who said evolution through natural selection is the most powerful idea in all of biology. And what we need to do is we need to apply the most powerful idea in all of biology to nutrition. And so now we suddenly have an organizational template that allows us to gain insight into complex diet health-related questions.
And that's what it's all about. And if you'll excuse the pun, the paleo concept is an evolving concept. It's continually being refined and developed, and you're certainly, Dr. Cordain, at the forefront of all that great research. Keep up the great work. Congratulations on achieving the recognition that you've had. You've influenced innumerable individuals, many of my patients, many of my listeners. It's made a big impression. But keep up the great work. Keep up getting the information out. And for listeners, you have a website, of course, that is?
ThePaleoDiet.com.
Okay, ThePaleoDiet.com. And there you can find all the publications and all the books and lots of DVDs and informational sections that I think will move you closer towards optimal health. Thank you very much, Dr. Lauren Cordain, for joining us.
Thank you, Dr. Hoffman. It's always been a pleasure, Ron, and you do a great job with these interviews, and I enjoy talking with you.
No, it's a mutual pleasure. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.